Well, as you know, September 30th marked the first National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, a day set aside by our federal government earlier this year to honor the lost children and survivors of residential schools, their families and communities. And I just wanted to let you know, as a part of our series on Journey Toward Reconciliation, later this month, Bridget Finley, who works with the Mennonite Central Committee, one of our ministry partners, she works in the Indigenous Neighbors Program. And so she's going to be coming and sharing with us a story and stories of reconciliation. And also working on a workshop as well, where we can have a lot more interaction. And I just want to encourage you, on our website we put some resources, but I watched a film called Yumo Comes Home, a 28-minute documentary about two people that spoke at our church here about 6 or 7 years ago, Isidore Charters and Don Clausen from Sardis Community Church out in the valley. And it has just been done in the last couple of years, and it's a really powerful story. And those of you especially who heard them in person will be really interested and eager to watch that. Stories are so important. And over the last couple of weeks, we have been immersing ourselves in biblical stories of reconciliation. Actually, we've been looking at the resolution of some family feuds. One involving Jacob and his father-in-law, Laban. And also, we'll be looking at Jacob and Esau. And I think it reminds us that reconciliation is a journey, as one writer put, often a long and fragile journey. So far in the Jacob story, the relationship between Jacob and Laban has been resolved, not with full reconciliation, but with a peace treaty and a mutually agreed upon boundaries. We're not going to fight anymore. In fact, we're going to make some commitments that we're going to honor and keep. Now, those were physical boundary that they put in place. Sometimes I think we have to have, sometimes we set conversational boundaries between us. I was talking to someone this week, and it's like, we can't quite touch that topic or it just goes badly. So we've agreed so far, we're going to put that one on hold so we can keep growing in our relationship with each other, and hopefully we'll get to that one someday. Well, in chapters Genesis, and you can invite you to turn to Genesis, book of Genesis, we're going to be looking at chapter 33 today. In Genesis 32 and 33, the story turns from that of Jacob and Laban. It returns to the larger story between that of Jacob and his twin brother Esau. And it appears there is no chance of moving forward in Jacob's life with God without facing his past, a past that had ended in a civil war. You see, Esau's last words must have rung in Jacob's ears for a long time. You remember what those words were? I will kill my brother Jacob. Those words were probably etched on Jacob's mind and his emotions for all those years. And so as Jacob begins his journey home, he tries to message his brother in diplomatic fashion, hoping to cool his anger and appease him with a long line of gifts that he is sending ahead. And here's the message that he sent. We have it from text message, apparently. Your servant Jacob says, I have been staying with Laban and have remained there until now. I have cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, male and female servants. Now I am sending this message to my Lord that I may find favor in your eyes. He gets a message back, but he gets it from his messengers, and it sounds kind of ominous because they say, we went to your brother Esau, and now he is coming to meet you with 400 men are with him. Jacob must have hoped for the best, but as we come to chapter 33, we see that he seems to be busy preparing for the worst. Let's read Genesis 33, beginning at verse 1. Jacob looked up. And there was Esau, coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two female servants. He put the female servants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. "Who are these with you?" he asked. Jacob answered, "They are the children God has graciously given your servant." Then the female servants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Esau asked, "What's the meaning of all these flocks and herds I met?" "To find favor in your eyes, my lord," he said. But Esau said, "I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." "No, please," said Jacob. "If I have found favor in your eyes, accept the gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God. Now that you have received me favorably, please accept the present that was brought to you. For God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need." And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. Then Esau said, "Let us be on our way. I'll accompany you." But Jacob said to him, "My lord knows that the children are tender and that I must care for the ewes and cows that are nursing their young. For if they are driven hard, just one day all the animals will die. So let my lord go on ahead of his servant while I move along slowly at the pace of the flocks and herds before me and the pace of the children until I come to my lord in Seir." Esau said, "Then let me leave some of my men with you." "Oh, but why do that?" Jacob asked. "Just let me find favor in the eyes of my lord." So that day, Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. That is why the place is called Succoth, or shelters. After Jacob came from Paddan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan and camped within sight of the city. For 100 pieces of silver, he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the plot of ground where he pitched his tent. Then he set up an altar and called it Eloi Israel. Well, this chapter describes what one writer called the long and dreaded meeting of Jacob and Esau, told in a number of scenes. In the first scene, verses 1 to 3, we see Jacob fearing the worst, arranging his family from the least with the servants to the greatest, that is the most important in the back. And it was probably so that if Esau did attack them, the ones Jacob valued most would have the best chance of getting away. And one writer said, you know, the stream of gifts and the big family procession, almost comically overarranged, you know, as it turned out, gives some idea, though, of the load that Jacob was carrying in his mind and in his emotions and his conscience. It looks a lot like what Jacob had been doing before that wrestling match with God that you looked at last week in chapter 32. And yet something significant has changed. Since his divine encounter with God, instead of sending the gifts in his family all ahead as a buffer, you compare chapter 32, verse 21. There, they all went ahead, but here now in chapter 33, we read that now he himself went on ahead. He goes from the back, now he goes to the front to lead the way, to face his brother, even though Jacob is now weaker and more vulnerable than ever. He is limping from that dislocated socket. It was probably the greatest risk that Jacob had ever taken. I wonder, what's the biggest risk you've ever taken? I remember watching bungee jumpers going off one of these bridges in the interior, and I contemplated it for a minute, but I thought, I'm not going to risk that. There's other things as well, but as I thought about that more, I thought, you know what? I think it's the relational and emotional risks that have been the greatest in my life. Asking my wife out on the first date, you know, these are big risks. And taking a step in a journey toward reconciliation often requires us to face some of our biggest fears and take some of our biggest risks. Now, as the one who had swindled his elder brother out of his birthright and blessing, Jacob had good reason to fear Esau's vengeance and retribution. But his dramatic change in posture, Jacob's regret and repentance for the injustice that he had done, and in the actions that follow, he will display his desire to make amends. And we will look at that in more detail, but all of these steps in this journey are very important. That step of Jacob's shift in posture is notable. Now, usually a single bow was sufficient to express one's humility. That's what Abraham did in previous chapters in Genesis. But to bow seven times, that was more like how a servant would approach his lord and master. When a great king, the ruling king, has his subject kings come, they come and bow seven times. We have some Armenia letters that from ancient world that describe that. So this is one who is coming before his lord and master. And notice Jacob's language all the time, my lord, my lord, my lord. Some have wondered, is this a false humility? I think this is a genuine humility. I think it is a genuine humility born out of just having been in the presence of the one who is truly great, God himself. And he has realized his smallness. I remember years ago, my son Nathan, he loved this guitar player called Tommy Emmanuel. And there was tickets on sale in Seattle, and another friend at the church who was a great guitar player, Pete, he told us about it, and I thought, oh, we're going to get tickets for that. And so the three of us went down to listen to Tommy Emmanuel, and I was just absolutely in awe. It was a guitar I had just never seen or heard it played like that. And Pete, our friend Pete, was a tremendous guitar player. And yet as we talked on our way home from that, he said, I don't think I can play the guitar again. I just feel like a failure. Humbled, absolutely humbled. And it gives me a window into Jacob. He has been humbled. He is no longer under any illusion that he is a self-made person or that he can manipulate his way through this. Or that everything that he has been achieved because he has pulled himself up by his own bootstraps, you know, from rags to riches. I mean, he had worked hard 20 years for Laban, but it would have all come to nothing through injustice if God had not watched over him and had come to his defense. We saw that in the previous chapters. And it is Jacob's trust in God that has helped him in this journey to face his deepest fears. The greatest surprise is Esau's response. Esau's response is not at all what Jacob feared, and I think it is beyond what he could have hoped for in his wildest dreams. Instead of rushing to attack him and get revenge, Esau, it says, ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. There must have been a whole puddle of tears there. Tears of sorrow and tears of joy. It was the kind of response and embrace. I had never seen this before. One commentator flagged it. It's the same response and embrace given by the father to the prodigal son in Jesus' parable in the New Testament. Look for a moment at these two verses from Luke 15, verse 20, that prodigal, that meeting described there between the prodigal son and his father, and here Jacob and Esau. And it says, he ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. It is identical language. One writer, Derek Kidner, said, our Lord could find no better model for the prodigal father at this point than Esau. How upside down. He is the one who gives this tremendous grace-filled response. Might wonder at the lack of comment by the narrator at this point. It seems surprising, and yet we will discover it was a holy, life-changing moment that Jacob will describe as nothing less than seeing the face of God. Now, we must remember that in the Old Testament, no one could see the face of God and live. One of the closest that ever got there was Moses, and he got to see God's glory from the back. And it was almost overwhelming. Isaiah, when he is in the presence of God, he just comes undone. And in John chapter 1 in the New Testament, it is interesting. In John 1 verse 1, it says, "In the beginning was God, was the Word, sorry, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." It's referring to Jesus coming, this divine Word that said all, brought all of creation into being. And yet in the Greek, it says, actually it says, "And the Word was toward God." I remember our Greek teacher, Dr. David Ewart, saying, the image there is they have been face to face. The one who has been face to face with God has now come down to us. Jesus is the only one that saw and lived with God face to face. And yet Jacob is saying, oh, this feels as good as the best thing I can imagine. See, because earlier Jacob had met God when he was fleeing and he had nothing and he was asleep on a pillow at a place called Bethel. And he will say, God, he has a vision of God, and he will say, surely the Lord is in this place, and I was totally unaware of it. And now he will say, I recognize this is God. And so following their heartfelt embrace, Esau looks up and he sees the others now behind Jacob, and he asks him, who are they? And Jacob's response here and in the verses that follow are telling and reflective of his own inner spiritual transformation. Notice how Jacob describes his family, his children in verse 5, as those God has graciously given him. God language will come out here time and again. Later in verse 11, he will explain his desire to give generously because God has been gracious to me. And most important of all, he will describe his experience and seeing Esau's favor rather than Esau's frown as like seeing the face of God. And so when Esau asks for the meaning of all these flocks and herds he has met on the way, we discover also a change in purpose. They are still his gift to Esau, but now they are no longer a bribe given to try and appease him, but a gift of gratitude for the wondrous gift of forgiveness, acceptance that he has received, which is invaluable to him. Indeed, he who had lived so much of his life, you know, like Ebenezer Scrooge, grasping, right, is now transformed in one eager to give. Indeed, though the NIV translation says that his gift has been given as a present, verse 11, it's actually exactly the same Hebrew word used back in chapter 27 to describe the blessing he had stolen from Esau. That blessing that I stole, here I'm giving it back. That's what is happening here. He is eager to make things as right as possible. Restitution, we can call it different words, but he is eager to make things the wrongs, to correct the wrongs, to make things as good as possible. And it says, and because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. Esau accepted Jacob's desire to make restitution and to be reconciled. That is part of this journey as well. And I think it's an important lesson for us as well. Many people try to earn God's favor. They think God's got some scales, you know, and if you do enough good things that outweigh the bad, you know, then you're going to be good with God. Is that how we do it in our relationship? No, kids, I'm going to be angry with you as a father until you do enough to make up for all the bad that you've done. I hope we don't, because that's not the way God is. Our Father is like Esau was. He is waiting for them not to try and earn his favor, but to accept the favor that is already given. Esau responds to Jacob's gift by offering him to come and be family. Let's be family once again in my home country, in my home city of area of Seir. Now, one might have thought that Jacob would be eager to embrace such a generous and gracious offer. And so, yet he rejects it. And so numerous commentators have differed over the reasons why he would reject that. According to Gerhard von Rad, Jacob's refusal shows the mistrust of one who himself has often deceived. So he's like, I think it means he doesn't really fully trust his brother. Maybe it's a reflection of himself. The Reformed commentator John Calvin suggested that perhaps Esau's charity wouldn't last. You know, and before long there would be a new cause of conflict that might arise before them, and it would just all come down like a house of cards. Well, I think there could be another very important reason as well. I think it's the most important reason. In chapter 31, verse 3, God had told Jacob to return home to the promised land. The larger story of Genesis is about God taking for himself a people into a land, a special, the promised land. And God had told him to return, and he himself had given God his word on oath that he would do that, back in chapter 28. If you keep me safe, God, through this, when I'm fleeing like a refugee, and you somehow bring me back home safely, I will follow you. I will dwell in this land and continue your work of shalom. So perhaps Jacob did not want to spoil the reunion, this wonderful reunion, by turning Esau down. I mean, the preciousness of having found favor in Esau's eyes. And I think there's a little bit of Middle Eastern negotiation going on here. You see, in Middle Eastern way, and we actually have some of this as well, but there it's like you first make an offer, and then the person in response says, oh no, I couldn't accept, you know, such gracious hospitality. This is all part of it. And the next one, then the person insists, oh no, you really need to come. And the person then is rejecting it, you know, again, but maybe a bit softer. They're trying to read, is this really, do they really want me to come over for dinner, you know, after? Or if they've got a whole celebration, I would just be intruding on that. And I really, you know, they need to be hospitable, but maybe I shouldn't really accept this offer. And so there could be some of this negotiation that is the kind of expected, and yet maybe he's partly turning that down as well. And maybe he's turning it down because, you know, he doesn't want to spoil it. Now, whatever the reasons for Jacob's refusal, we don't know exactly. I do agree with commentator Gordon Wenham when he says that most of these different motives, they're not mutually exclusive. There may be elements of each. You know, there may be still some mistrust. Maybe there's still a fear of ruining the reunion. And maybe it is he wants to keep his promise to God to return to the promised land. And he doesn't know, if I go and live with Esau for a while, will that be hard to break away again? You know, his oath to return, Jacob's oath to God to return to the promised land would have carried a lot of weight. All the promises were connected to that. And yet I do wonder, why is he not more honest with Esau? You know, does he mean, I will come see you sometime? Geographically, just put the slide up for a moment. If you see, so Jacob had come all the way from the north. You can see that on the slide on your left-hand side, down. And then I blew up the box on the map to see, you know, Esau's seer is down to the south. But Jacob, as soon as Esau and his men leave, he goes west. That does seem a little dishonest, doesn't it? Maybe he had a hard time being honest, but I think he should have been as honest and open as he could. Well, we will move on. We come to the closing verses. Closing verses, verses 18 to 20. And although they seem kind of mundane, just kind of wrapping things up, they are actually of immense significance to the larger story in Genesis. For they tell us that Jacob actually did reach Canaan, the promised land, after having come back from Paddan Aram in the north, or Haran. And he also, it is telling us, made it his permanent home. He bought real estate there, okay? He invested himself, a homestead, and he built an altar there. And he called it Eloi Israel. El is the God of Israel. This was a public and permanent declaration of the God he served. You see, everybody always in that culture identified the gods, and often they had them as idols. But he didn't believe in idols, right? But he did have something that represented worship to his God, an altar, where he'd make sacrifices. And so he's letting all of his neighbors know, this is the God I serve and whom I worship. And it also marked the fulfillment of that earlier vow and promise that if God would bring him back in peace, then the Lord will be my God. And so I think it is appropriate that this journey toward reconciliation with his brother, it concludes with worship. It concludes with worship. Well, I want to, a few lessons from the story. There, I'm sure there are others. I just tried to boil it down to a few. You know, the first is that God always has a redemptive plan. Maybe you have a relationship or experience in life and you say, I have just blown it so badly. Like Humpty Dumpty, all the king's horses and all the king's men couldn't put them back together again. But you know what? Things can't always get restored exactly the same way, but God always has a healing, a restorative way forward. He always does. And that is good news. A plan for healing the hurt and the harm. Now, it's not always, even often, a return to exactly the way things were. Often that's not possible. But a restored way of relating to one another and a new future. And God's plan will be in his time and in his way. God seems really slow sometimes. This is a 20-year process, but this was a really big conflict. And in the book of Numbers, Numbers chapter 14, Israel, they were going to enter the promised land, and then they didn't have enough faith, and they said, no, we're not going to do it. And they rebelled against God's word. And then Moses said, well, this is really going to be bad for you. And then the next day they discussed, yeah, you're right, we were wrong, we're change of heart, we're going to go and do it. But they presumed that now was the time to do it in their way, and they failed miserably. We need to follow God has a plan, but we need to follow his time and his way. And the next step. Next slide. God's plan includes a posture shift. Not posturing. That's what we often do in the relationship. You know, our defenses get up and how can I maintain some control or power here? No, it's a posture shift here. Humility. Jacob's midnight counter with God in the previous chapter had left him physically weak, but spiritually stronger, more reliant. His resilience had plummeted, but his reliance on God had gone way up. The old Jacob, oh, he knew how to gain the upper hand over others, manipulation, deception. But ironically, it is only the newer, humbler, weaker Jacob that gains what he has most wanted, favor with God and with others, especially with his brother. And once that obstacle of Jacob's character is resolved, one commentator said, the obstacle of conflict dissipates quite easily. Now that Jacob has become a man of faith that God wants him to be, he takes his rightful place as the covenant heir. Now he's the kind of leader that God can use. I wonder, how does a change of heart and posture happen? It's God's doing, but often God needs to give us new eyes and new ears to hear. I was reading a book on reconciliation recently, and there was a powerful story in there of cross-racial reconciliation. The writer talked about how she would take students, in this case, black and white students together, and visit places of oppression together, hoping to heal some of the racial divisions. And they visited a museum that had graphic illustrations of lynchings that had taken place. And most of the students were just absolutely speechless. And after they left, they went back to the van and they just in their you know the bus and they sat there for a little bit. And then one of the black students, she stood up and she said, "All white people are evil." Well, and wanting to defend themselves, you know, there was a whole barrage of discussion that took place. You know, I wasn't responsible for it and all of that. And the leader just thought, how is this going to get any resolve? It's just now the students are just divided. And suddenly one of the white female students stood up to speak and everybody seemed to hold their breath. What is she going to say? And instead of another round of, please don't blame me for this, she said, I don't know what to do with what I have just seen. I can't fix your pain. I can't take it away, but I can see it. And I will work the rest of my life to fight for you and for your children so that they won't experience it. And she started to weep, and the mascara on her eyes was running down her cheeks, leaving these dark streaks. And the bus was silent. And then one of the students stood up and said aloud, "She's crying black tears." She's crying black tears. And indeed, she was crying black tears. The black students on that bus now understood that someone identified with their pain and their experience. And it was a profound moment of identification for them. I think that in this story, as they wept, Jacob was crying Esau's tears. And I think that is an important way of how a posture shift happens. And then the next steps that take place from there. And I remember being at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission when it came to Vancouver and sitting in the listening circles. As our Indigenous neighbors shared stories of unbelievable pain. And all I could do was just weep and afterward thank them for the courage in sharing their stories. Well, thirdly, God's plan for reconciliation follows a pattern. It follows a pattern. And I just want to put up a slide, the other slide, for a moment. This is from Ron Clausen. He's worked as a mediator for decades. And he's tried to summarize down a peacemaking model when he works with people that are conflicted and tries to help mediate. And he's found that forgiveness, when it's two-way, is mutual recognition that, one, injustices are recognized. And we see that in this story, right? And secondly, that equity is restored. How do we make things as right as possible? And we saw that in the Jacob and Esau story here as well, right? And then third, that future intentions are clear. Not so much in the Jacob and Esau story. We saw that in the Jacob and Laban story. But I think it tells us Jacob was not as honest as he should have been, nor as fully obedient as God wanted him to be. And it will cost him in the next story, but that's for another day. But I want to leave you with just a couple questions. Do you believe God has a redemptive plan for you? Do you believe that? Are you willing to make a posture shift? God, let my heart be broken by the things that break your heart. And thirdly, are you willing to and ready to work through the past for a new future? I want to invite the worship team up, and as they're coming, it's just a moment of silence, and then I thinking about that, and then I will pray. Let's just listen first before God how he would speak to each of us today. Oh, reconciling God, we thank you that you are the one who always has a redemptive plan. Your redemptive plan cost you your very dearest son, his life, humiliation, mistreatment, shame. And you did that for us because you have this dream of restoring all things. Lord, may you restore us this day. May we commit ourselves to a posture shift, not only with you, but also with those with whom we need to be reconciled. Lord, lead the way, and may we be eager to follow your direction. Amen.